Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Monday, on my way to work, I saw a little flock of pigeons suddenly take to the air a few feet in front of my car. I spent a few extra seconds at a stop sign to admire them and consider how cool it would be to rise into the air at will and dance through the sky. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's not just birds who fly, of course, but insects and bats as well, along with a number of creatures that can't power themselves through flight but glide on the air quite nicely given the right conditions. So why can some animals fly while most cannot? David E. Alexander teaches in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Kansas. His new book is called On the Wing: Insects, Pterosaurs, Birds, Bats, and the Evolution of Animal Flight. David, welcome to Think.
Hi. Nice to be here.
What are the evolutionary benefits of flight? What can you do better if you can fly than you can if you are confined to moving on the ground?
Well, there are quite a few advantages to being able to fly. One is just the ability to be up above everything. If you are a mouse and you're down in the foliage, you can't see very far because the foliage gets in the way. If you're a sparrow, you can take off and get up above everything and see much farther. So for anything that involves searching, there's a big advantage just because your perspective is so much better. You can see much farther. Another thing that you can do if you can fly is you can go much faster. The physics of flight requires a flyer to go typically about 10 times faster than a walker or runner of the same size. So if you need to cover any distance, flying becomes a big advantage because, for example, I often see great blue herons around here flying from where they nest to the nearest river, which may be a couple miles away. And it's hard to imagine an animal the size of a great blue heron walking that far back and forth just to get food every day. So those are the big ones. From those, you can kind of think of other things like getting into places that are inaccessible by walking. After Mount St. Helens exploded, the first animals that appeared in the devastated areas were flying insects. Flies were some of the first colonizers. And it's the same with islands. You know, if a volcano erupts and creates a new island, animals that can fly can get there a whole lot faster than, or maybe at all, compared to animals that can't fly. And so barrier crossing is an important one. Animals routinely fly across deserts and ice caps that, again, a similar-sized walking animal would never be able to get across. So that just kind of gives you the flavor. You can, with a little thought, you can come up with even more.
Okay, David, I'm sold. I'm convinced that I would very much like to be able to fly, but clearly the fact that most creatures on this earth can't fly means that there must be some trade-offs required.
Yeah, it's kind of an open question exactly what the trade-offs are, but maybe a better way to think about it is kind of the hurdle you have to get over. The hurdle to get over to glide. You mentioned gliding animals. Most people have probably heard of flying squirrels. It turns out there's a huge variety of animals that can glide. There's frogs that can glide. There are fish that can glide. There's even some snakes that can glide.
Ugh.
And so the evolutionary hurdle to get over to become a glider is not all that great. You basically just need to have something that increases your surface area. But to flap, to fly under power, that's a big hurdle. And the reason that's a big hurdle is partly because it requires a more sophisticated control system, that is the nervous system. You have to be able to control the muscles, coordinate the muscles, the flight muscles. The muscles have to be strong. In a bird, for example, the flight muscles make up a huge fraction of the body weight. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 or 30% of the body weight is muscle, just to power those wings. And so the modifications to the control system, the modifications to the anatomy, to the physiology, are all fairly extreme, to the point where something like a bat, we don't know of any bats that have lost the ability to fly because they are so highly specialized to be able to fly, it becomes difficult for them to make a living without being able to fly.
Should we assume that today's gliders, some of them might be in transition to or from the ability to flap wings at will?
Well, that's a tough question, but I think the odds are that probably not. And the reason that I say that is because when birds evolve flight, there weren't very many other animals around that could compete with them or that could prey on them as flying animals. And the same is true for insects, a little less true for bats, but that's probably why they're nocturnal. Nowadays, you've got birds that fill the skies during the day. You've got bats that fill the skies at night. And it would be ecologically and evolutionarily a big challenge for an animal to evolve powered flight now because there are already so many animals doing that already. Now, if there were some catastrophe that some kind of super epidemic that wiped out all the birds, then you might think about coming back in a couple million years and seeing if flying squirrels evolve powered flight. But under current modern conditions, it's pretty unlikely that a gliding animal would evolve powered flight. And, you know, biologists used to think of gliding animals as being sort of in transition to powered flight, but nowadays we've come around to a different way of thinking about them, and generally biologists consider gliding animals to be well adapted to a gliding lifestyle and getting advantages from gliding and not necessarily some sort of a transition form onto powered flight.
With all the benefits that come from flying, why would some creatures lose that ability? Why are there flightless birds, for example?
Well, it depends on the situation. There are a number of flightless water birds. Penguins are a good example. They had ancestors that could fly, but they have become so specialized for swimming underwater that they lost the ability to fly in air. They kind of fly underwater. There was a bird in the Arctic that kind of fulfilled the same ecological role in the Arctic that penguins fulfill in the Antarctic. This bird in the Arctic was called the great auk. And the family that the great auks are in includes a bunch of birds that can fly, like puffins. And not only can they fly, but they flap their wings underwater to swim. So they swim kind of the same way that they fly in air, which is pretty cool. But what that means is that they're maybe not as good of flyers as birds that don't fly underwater. And the great auk was called great because it was big. It was the size of a large penguin. And in that situation, what most likely happened was there was an advantage to being big for those birds, and they reached a size where, in order to get any bigger, they could still swim, but they couldn't produce enough power to actually fly. And so the advantage became becoming an expert swimmer at the expense of being able to fly. Now, there's other birds like ostriches and emus. Again, they are highly specialized runners. And so in that situation, there was probably some bird, maybe not unlike a roadrunner of today, that can still fly. But it reached a size where the advantage to getting bigger outweighed the advantage to being able to fly. And so they specialized in the in the direction of getting bigger. Because if you're big, there are some advantages like being bigger than your predators and that sort of thing. So with all these kinds of things, there's some kind of a cost and some kind of a benefit. Another one that I talk about in the book is parasitic insects. There's a bunch of parasitic insects like fleas and lice that had ancestors that could fly, but fleas and lice nowadays can't fly. And the apparent benefit is that they can just use their hosts as their dispersal mechanism and not have to put their own energy into it. If you don't have to put your own energy into dispersing, you can do away with wings and flight muscles, and life becomes a little bit cheaper as far as energy. So there are all kinds of reasons why an animal might evolve the loss of wings, and these are some of the more obvious examples.
What's the relationship between legs or limbs and wings?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. In insects, the wings evolve from something completely separate from the legs. So you've got insects like silverfish, which are still around today, but their ancestors never had wings. They've got six legs. If you look at the flying insects, they also have six legs. And so what that means is to evolve wings, insects didn't have to give up a pair of legs. And if you look at birds, some of the earliest ancestors of birds apparently kind of used their front and hind legs both as wings. But the ones that became successful and the ones that became the progenitors of the lineage that led to flying birds, they pretty much gave up using their hind legs for wings and just used the front legs. And so that means they have the hind legs still available for getting around on the ground. And so you have birds that have gone the other direction, like we just talked about, the ostriches, that gave up wings because they have powerful hind legs and they can get around on the ground. And the same with insects. The fleas can get around just fine on the ground because they still have the same number of legs that they had before they had wings. Then you have animals like bats, where the hind leg is actually part of the flapping mechanism. It helps to control and support the wing membrane when they flap. And so the hind leg is specialized for this role as part of the wing mechanism. And in bats, you just don't see bats that can get around as well on the ground as other mammals because both the front and hind legs are specialized for flapping. And so we don't see any wingless bats. We don't see any bats that have lost the ability to fly. And my sense of it is because the hind legs are part of the flight mechanism. And in order to be good at walking on the ground, you'd have to make the flight mechanism less effective. But bats are so highly specialized for flying, anything that makes the wing less effective is going to be very hard to be outweighed by some other benefit.
David E. Alexander is my guest. He teaches in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Kansas. His new book is called On the Wing: Insects, Pterosaurs, Birds, Bats, and the Evolution of Animal Flight. Join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with David E. Alexander of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Kansas. His new book is called On the Wing: Insects, Pterosaurs, Birds, Bats, and the Evolution of Animal Flight. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. David, insects were the first creatures on Earth to fly. How long have they been doing it?
Well, we know from fossils that there were insects that were fully powered flyers at least 350 million years ago. And since they were obviously flyers by that time, they had to have evolved that ability sometime earlier than that. Now, there's a little bit of controversy because we don't have any fossils of insects with wings any earlier than that, but there is a pair of insect jaws that were discovered back in the 1930s or so that a colleague of mine here at the University of Kansas named Michael Engel looked at a couple years ago, and he realized that these jaws, even though they were 400 million years old, they seem to have characteristics that indicate they could have been from a winged insect. Now, when all you have to work with is the jaws, it's kind of hard to say, you know, maybe it was evolutionary convergence or something like that. But there is some evidence that the earliest flying insects were a lot older than 350 million years and possibly as old as 400 million years.
This is a naive question for someone like you, I'm sure, but how hard is it to find well-preserved insect remains from 350 or even 400 million years ago?
It's not easy. It depends on the location. There are some sites where you can walk down a creek bed and every rock you turn over has some kind of a fossil, not all insect fossils, but plant fossils or fossils of some other kind of organism. There are other places where if you get really, really lucky, then you might find a fossil. The place where these jaws were found, for example, is the remains of a hot mineral spring. And the jaws were actually embedded in translucent flint. And so it was just quite a stroke of luck that the original collector noticed that there was something embedded in this flint and was able to collect it and put it into a collection of the British Museum. Hmm. It really depends on what kind of organism you're looking for. There are areas where there are abundant fossils of different organisms. And in fact, here in Kansas, just a couple hours' drive from my office, there's a place called the Elmo Fossil Beds, and there is a creek bed that you can walk down, and there are just lots of insect fossils in the rocks in that creek bed. Now, most of the good ones have been picked up, and so if you want to get any good ones now, you have to do some excavating. But it really depends on what you're looking for in the time period. One very frustrating thing is that period when we're pretty sure that insects were evolving wings, sometime between 400 million years ago and 350 million years ago, unfortunately, is a time when we have very few terrestrial fossils. So, insects clearly evolved to fly on land, and the sources of fossils from that time are just incredibly sparse, and the few that are from that time are mostly marine, and so that doesn't help us much with insects. So the whole issue of the completeness of the fossil record boils down to the fact that there's just a lot of luck and a lot of random chance involved in finding good fossils.
Why do so many insects have two sets of wings?
Well, that's not a question with a real simple answer. One way to think about it is to think of the insect thorax. Insect body is made up of three parts, the head and the thorax and the abdomen. And the middle part, the thorax, is specialized for locomotion. It's the part that has the legs. Now, insects normally have three pairs of legs on the thorax. And the thorax actually is kind of a three-segmented structure. So the front segment has a pair of legs, and the middle segment has a pair of legs, and the back segment has a pair of legs. And with modern insects that have four wings, they have a pair of wings on the middle part of the thorax and the back part of the thorax, but they don't have a pair of wings on the front part of the thorax. And what is really interesting is that some of those insects from the Elmo fossil bed here in Kansas actually have a little pair of miniature wings on the front part of the thorax. Hmm. So they have three pairs of wings. And so the way to think about it really is that the thorax is kind of this three-segmented structure and may have initially had three pairs of wings. And as insects evolve, they simplified things a little bit and simplified it down to two pairs of wings. And there are some advantages to having two pairs of wings. It helps your maneuverability, but it has some inefficiencies. And so if you can get down to one pair of wings, that's more efficient. And that's what we see in modern insects like flies, which only have a single pair of wings.
Okay, real scientists apparently don't spend a lot of time on which came first, the chicken or the egg. But there has been tons of debate over whether bird flight started with running along the ground and lifting off or gliding down from the trees.
Yeah, and I'm kind of an interested bystander to that debate because my research area is really animal flight aerodynamics. One of the reasons that some scientists thought that birds evolved from runners is that they evolved from dinosaurs, particularly dinosaurs like Velociraptor, which are bipedal runners. And so if you've got your ancestral group being bipedal runners, then it makes a certain logical sense to think that flight evolved in some way associated with running. But on the other hand, people like myself who study the aerodynamics of flight look at that and say, but that's just not very efficient. It's much more efficient to start from the trees and glide down. That way you're working with gravity instead of against gravity. So there has long been kind of two camps. One camp that says birds must have evolved in trees and glided down, and so those are the trees down camp. And then the other camp is the people who study dinosaurs, and they say, no, they evolved from dinosaurs, so they must have evolved from the ground up. So we call them the ground up camp. What we now know is, thanks to a bunch of just totally spectacular and amazing fossils from China, is that there were actually very small dinosaurs that probably lived in trees, distant relatives of Velociraptor, that were not much bigger than a sparrow or a pigeon, and they lived in trees, and they had feathers. They probably were not using their feathers for wings, but most likely they were using their feathers for insulation, because small animals, it's harder for them to stay warm. So with the knowledge that, yes, birds did evolve from these theropod dinosaurs, but we do have theropod dinosaurs that were up in trees, then we can, at least I'm quite comfortable saying that it seems really unlikely that they evolved from running. And it seems much more likely that the ancestors of birds started out up in trees and started out as gliders.
We know that there were flying creatures during the time of the dinosaurs, but they don't seem to be direct relatives of today's birds.
That's true. There were pterosaurs, which are not at all related to birds in any way at all,
right,
except that they're sort of in the big group with birds and dinosaurs and crocodiles. But the birds that were around then were mostly these birds that they have no common name. Scientists sometimes call them opposite birds because the Latin version of their family name means opposite birds, and it has to do with the structure of their shoulder. And they were actually quite common and probably the dominant birds of the time in the last few million years of the dinosaurs. But they seem to have disappeared along with the dinosaurs, and this other kind of small lineage of mostly sea and shore birds survived that catastrophe that took out the dinosaurs, and that little small lineage is what led to all the modern birds. So you're absolutely right. The opposite birds were by far the most common birds before, when there were still dinosaurs, but after that asteroid impact or whatever it was that killed off the dinosaurs, the lineage leading to modern birds, which had split off long before, was the only one that, that got through that catastrophe.
Today, at least walking around, you know, in cities, we associate flight with animals that are relatively small. But I wonder if you can tell us about Quetzalcoatlus northropi.
Well, appropriately enough, it's the largest known pterosaur, which also makes it the largest known flying animal of any kind. And it was found in Texas. It was found probably, if I remember right, back in the 1970s. And the frustrating thing about it is that a bunch of smaller ones were found. And when I say smaller, these were still bigger than condors. But they found one arm bone, one upper arm bone, that was twice as big as the arm bones of all the other ones. And I'm not a paleontologist, but a good paleontologist who studies pterosaurs can look at these arm bones and tell instantly it's not a dinosaur, it's a pterosaur. So they found this one huge upper arm bone, and when they calculated that in proportion to these other more complete pterosaur skeletons they found, it came out to have this enormous wingspan, a wingspan actually longer than the wingspan of a Piper cub. Now, the animal itself probably stood about 7 or 8 feet tall at the shoulders and probably walked on two legs. That's the best evidence that we have right now, although it probably could also use its front limbs as kind of almost like crutches as it moved around. And what is really interesting about that is people who really know about fossils have come up with hugely different estimates of how heavy it might have been. There is one estimate in a big review of pterosaurs from a few years ago that they weighed about 70 kilograms, which is somewhere around 160 pounds or something in that neighborhood. That's not much more than me, and yet you're talking about an animal that stood 7 foot tall at the shoulders and had a 20-some foot wingspan. That seems a little on the low side. And then another scientist made some computer models, basically, and used those to estimate the weight. And he came up with an estimate of 500 kilograms, which is about a half a ton. And to me, it just seems inconceivable that it could have flown if it weighed a half ton. And if it couldn't fly, why did it have a 20-foot wingspan? So I think that the reality must be somewhere in the middle. Certainly not a half ton, but certainly more than 150 pounds. I'm thinking probably something in the neighborhood of 300 or 400 pounds, something like that.
What is special?
And that was big. Well, I just wanted to say that was big. There was actually quite a large bird before the last ice age in South America called the giant teratorn, and it was about twice as big as the modern condor. So there were big birds in the past as well.
Why was everything so big back then?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you ask that because I was just talking about that with engineer here in the studio before we got started. And there really isn't one good, simple explanation for it, but there's a lot of things that may be related. At various times in the past, the oxygen content of the atmosphere has been higher than it is now. And if the oxygen content is higher, that means it's easier for your respiratory system to deliver oxygen around to your tissues, and so you can have more tissues, and that means you can get bigger. And we think that may have contributed to the particularly to the giant insects back in the Carboniferous, like the dragonflies with 2 and 3 foot wingspans. As far as the dinosaurs and the pterosaurs, there may also have been some time, some period back then with higher oxygen, although it wasn't as dramatic as in the Carboniferous. That might have had something to do with it. There are also hints that perhaps there were ways of escaping predation by getting big. A lot of large animals today have no predators because they're bigger than all their predators. Think of things like whale sharks and that sort of thing. Nothing eats them because nothing is big enough to eat them. And so there may have been some element of animals that were kind of big to start with anyway and maybe had some physiological or anatomical propensity to increase size when there's only small benefits. And the advantage of being big for escaping predation may have been one of those things that was important in dinosaurs. Of course, it's an arms race, and so then you've got predators that get big as well. But even so, the biggest predators were quite a bit smaller than the biggest non-predators.
It almost seems as if there would have been some advantage when everything else was gigantic to being very, very tiny back then. Like, you can escape the notice of something so hungry that it needs to eat, you know, a giant animal.
Well, that's absolutely right. And it's certainly the case because there were mammals back then at the time of the dinosaurs, but they were all sort of mouse or mole sized. And there was nothing like an elephant or a rhinoceros or anything like that. So mammals were there, but they were tiny and they were fairly obscure. There were small dinosaurs. As I mentioned, we know from a lot of fossils that have just come out in the last 10 or 15 years in China that there were a number of relatives of T-Rex and Velociraptor that were on the small side. So there were definitely small ones around back then, and one of the most common early birds back then was about the size of a sparrow or a robin.
David E. Alexander is my guest. He joins us from the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Kansas. His new book is On the Wing: Insects, Pterosaurs, Birds, Bats, and the Evolution of Animal Flight. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with David E. Alexander. He teaches in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Kansas. His new book is On the Wing: Insects, Pterosaurs, Birds, Bats, and the Evolution of Animal Flight. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. David, I was surprised to read that scientists cannot say definitively who the closest relatives of bats are. What animal is the closest relative of bats?
Well, that is kind of surprising when you think about it, because they are the most recent animals to have evolved powered flight, most likely sometime around the time when the dinosaurs died out, so 65 million years ago. So that makes them almost 100 million years younger than birds. The problem with that is that bats split off from the lineage of the rest of the animals so far back that, this is going to sound crazy, but their nearest relatives are in a group that contains cattle and horses and whales.
Wow.
So what that means is their connection to the rest of the mammals is so far back that we don't really know what their direct ancestor looked like. And in fact, I was talking to a colleague about that who studies bats, and I said, so if you found something, if you found a fossil, and you thought it might have been an ancestral bat, but it was before they evolved wings, how would you be able to recognize it? Because their body is so specialized for flight. And he said, well, they have some teeth specializations that we might see. But if all you had was some body part that didn't have any teeth, you'd be pretty hard-pressed to tell that it was the ancestor of bats because they are just so specialized for flight that anything, you know, sort of before they evolved those specializations, it would be kind of hard to figure out. The unfortunate thing is that if the ancestor had survived, we would be able to find it easily nowadays with our modern genetic testing. We could use genes to figure out who they're most closely related to. But clearly, whatever their immediate ancestor was is no longer around. And if we have fossils of whatever that ancestor was, they haven't been recognized as direct bat ancestors.
Is there any other species that whose divergence from all the other mammals is as dramatic as that of bats?
Well,
would it be the water-dwelling mammals, maybe?
Possibly, although, well, no, actually not, because the cetaceans, the whales and porpoises, are actually closer to horses and cattle than either of them are to bats.
Wow.
So the only mammals that I can think of that are that have a lineage approaching the ancientness of bats is probably shrews. And shrews clearly split off from the rest of the mammal family tree pretty far back. But to get much farther back than that, you're looking at marsupials like kangaroos.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Sandy in Richardson. Hello, Sandy.
Hi. Very interesting show, and I'm sure the book is equally fascinating. I had a thought about when you were talking about finding the upper arm bone, I guess it was, of the creature that was so much huger than the ones that had been found previously, and you were speculating about weights of these flying or could it be possible that they could fly creatures. One of the things that you did not mention, and it's probably been considered, but you didn't mention it, so I'm curious. A number of birds and currently have hollow bones, and I don't know what the difference in strength is between the bone structure of bones that have the voids in them is compared with solid bones. But is that something that you've considered for the weight and size of these creatures?
Thanks for your call, Sandy.
That's a really interesting question. The first thing is that should be made clear is that there are birds that have air-filled bones. They basically have extensions of their respiratory system that extend into the bones. And that does make their skeleton much lighter because we have marrow in our bones, and that's much heavier. But there are also birds that don't have what we call pneumatic bones, that have bones just like a mammal in the sense of not having air in them. Now, these pterosaur bones do not have the signature, the indication that they were connected to the respiratory system. Now, that doesn't mean that they weren't. It just means that if they were connected to the respiratory system the same way as birds, the pores that are present don't look like the ones that birds have. It is quite likely that, well, it's known that some of the bones of pterosaurs did have air spaces. What's not clear, what we don't know for sure yet because we just don't have enough good comparative information, is whether the arm bones in particular were air-filled. Now, for something as big as these giant pterosaurs, it certainly would have been a huge advantage for them to have air-filled bones. But I have never actually seen this one very large humerus, this upper arm bone. I haven't seen that myself. I've only seen pictures of it in the journals, and that's just not enough detail to say, yes, it has the pores that made it an air-filled bone, or no, it didn't. So right now, the jury is kind of out on that. But it is interesting that you bring that up, because we definitely know that some of their vertebrae, some of their backbone, did have air spaces.
I was on vacation.
That is to say, the pterosaurs, where we have more complete skeletons.
I was on vacation this summer, and there was a hummingbird feeder outside the little cabin where we stayed, and I wasted far too much time watching these guys and taking slow motion videos with my phone. What is required for hovering flight, and why can't most birds do it?
Well, it really helps to be small. And it comes back to a major physiological principle. It's actually a physics principle, the surface-to-volume ratio. When you are small, it is as if you have less weight for the amount of surface area. When you are big, it is as if you have more weight for the amount of surface area that you have. And flight deals a lot with surface area. The wings, the surface area of the wings basically determines how much lift you can produce. So it helps to be small. But another factor is that the wing motion is more complex, because if you're flying forward, like you're a crow and you're flying, you know, across a field, then when you flap your wings, you really only need to be producing lift and thrust on the downstroke. The upstroke can be just sort of like a recovery stroke, like when you're rowing a boat and you take the oar out of the water. But when you're hovering, you cannot afford to have half of the time when you're flying be the recovery stroke. And so you need to be able to do something useful on the upstroke and the downstroke. And what hummingbirds do is they literally flip their wing upside down on the upstroke, so that on the upstroke, the bottom surface acts like the top, and they produce lift on the bottom surface of the wing as it is upside down. And so they get lift on both the upstroke and the downstroke. And there are birds that can hover briefly, and they're generally on the small side. A bird like a sparrow or a wren, they can hover briefly because they have the right combination of flexibility in their shoulder joint and small size that they can still carry off hovering. But once you get much bigger than that, you just have too much weight for the amount of wing surface area to be able to generate the lift that you need when you're standing still. Because basically the way a wing works is it works by having air move over it. So if you're flying forward, that's not a big problem. Your body movement produces the air movement. But if you're standing still, then all your wing movement, all the air movement comes from your muscles moving the wings. And when you get big, your muscles just can't move the wings fast enough, and the wings don't have enough surface area to produce lift on the upstroke and the downstroke. So you don't see birds like crow-sized birds or eagles or anything like that hovering. It's pretty much the small ones. And that's one area where the insects have huge advantage, because a big insect is basically hummingbird size.
We have an email from Vicky in Allen, who writes, "Your description of giving up wings or other evolutionary development sounds as if this was a deliberate decision of the species. My understanding is that evolution is brought about by accidental changes to the biology. I'm trying to understand how accidental mutations can cause the direction of evolution for an entire species."
Well, if I made it sound that way, it was not intentional. There's a common misconception that evolution is based on randomness. And it is true that the variation that evolution uses as its sort of working material comes from random processes like mutation and recombination of genes during sexual reproduction. And so that's where variation comes from. But if it were just random, then, some particular random trait might become common in the species just because of randomness. But it's not random. It's directed by natural selection. And it's all, as you astutely pointed out at the very beginning of the interview, it's all about costs and benefits. And so if there was some benefit that outweighed the cost of having some innovation, then that benefit will cause that trait to become more common in the population and eventually become fixed in the species. And so when you have an insect like a blood-feeding ancestor of a flea, then it was in that insect's best interest, it was more costly for that insect to fly away than to just stay on its host. And in that case, the cost of producing wings and wing muscles would be outweighed by the benefits of just staying on the host. And so if I made it sound like it was directed, that's not what I meant. But it, or if I made it sound like the insect had some conscious intention, that's certainly not what I meant. But there certainly is directionality in the sense that the benefits of any innovation have to outweigh the costs. And sort of the environment is kind of what's doing the directing. That's why we call it natural selection.
David, what are the biggest questions that even the best fossil samples cannot answer?
Well, you know, there are a lot of things that we'd really like to know about pterosaurs. That's probably one of the big mystery areas. Their structure is totally unlike any animal that flies today. And we'd really like to know, you know, does their wing beat look more like a bird or a bat? And we'd like to know things like, did they form pair bonds when they mated? Did they build nests? Did they incubate their eggs? Some of those things you can get from the fossils, but a lot of them you can't. You can't tell, for example, if they produce sounds. Maybe they used sounds to attract mates like birds. That's something that we just can't tell from the fossils. And so there are a lot of behavioral and physiological things that would help us understand how they lived and how they flew that we can't get from the fossils. At least we can't get it without a lot of guesses and a lot of assumptions.
Any doubt that flying animals are still evolving?
Oh, no. There's no doubt about that. All animals are embedded in an environment that, just by the nature of things, is going to have some changes going on. And if that environment changes so much that the animal has difficulty making a living or difficulty competing with other animals, then its population will be reduced and it might go extinct. But if it then has some variation, some variant appears in the population that gives it an advantage, that variant will propagate through the population and the population will change. And a change in gene frequency is how biologists define evolution. And the gene frequency, the change in the genes that we see is the change in the characteristics of the animal. And we actually have reasonably good evidence for this because there are some animals that have lost flight on islands just within the last 50,000 years. So it's definitely still going on.
Got to jump in here. David E. Alexander's new book is called On the Wing: Insects, Pterosaurs, Birds, Bats, and the Evolution of Animal Flight. David, it's been really interesting. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.